Welcome to episode 12 of the Haman Lee Mysteries Resolved podcast. My name is Debbie Simons. Today we're going to finish up our roster of relatively minor characters in this case, and then go on to a wrap-up and draw together some ideas of how I think this case could be resolved. Let's start out with our two final characters in my list that has included Hope Schaub, Robin Kelly Kleindienst, and Bilal Ahmed. I want to just make a brief mention of Don's stepmother on his father's side. I've mentioned her before. I said last time that I wasn't really going to include her at all, but I think she does deserve one small mention here. So, as I've said, I was wrong about this woman's first name. I thought her first name was Sharon, and I was very frustrated in trying to find out anything about her. Well, her first name is Sheila. And as far as I have been able to determine, she married Don Jr., that is Don's biological father, in 1996. And they are still married, at least as of 2020. I'm assuming they're still married now in 2025. She does not appear in this case at all. I only mention her because I find it very curious, very puzzling, that Hay seems to have thought, the impression that has always been created, is that Don III, the young man she fell for so hard, was living with his father, and it was just a bachelor establishment, and that one of the things that made him so attractive to her was that he had no interfering, meddling mother in the picture. Now, of course, he did have a mother in the picture, but she didn't know that at the time, that Anita Baird, Don's biological mother, lived less than half a mile away with her romantic partner, Catherine Michelle. So I'm going to assume that Sheila Kleindienst just kept out of the whole thing, stayed upstairs. I wonder if she ever even met Hay when Hay started coming over to Don's house, that is, the townhouse where he lived with his dad on Endicott Road in Bel Air. She may just have stayed out of the picture entirely, probably figuring that was the wisest thing to do. So I'm going to leave her at that. Don's father is going to come up in one brief mention, which we'll get to in a minute here, as I go on to my final side character, Catherine or Kathy Michelle. Catherine Michelle is important in this case for a couple of reasons. Number one, as I've said before, she owned a single-family home with an attached garage less than half a mile from Don Jr.'s townhouse. It's probably inappropriate for me to try to speculate on how Anita Baird and Catherine Michelle got together. They did live very close to each other. They may have run into each other in the neighborhood. The important thing is that by, I'm going to say, 1998, somewhere early in 1998 or even earlier, Catherine Michelle, Anita Baird, and Don Kleindienst III were all working at the same LensCrafters store at the Hunt Valley Mall, which was about 23 miles from Bel Air. And then, because of a change in company policy, they had to start transferring out. So Catherine Michelle originally, according to Deborah Renner in the relaunch of Undisclosed, went to the Towson Mall, and Don went to the Owings Mills Mall. But Catherine Michelle is going to end up being a manager, a store manager, at the Owings Mills Mall, at which Don is already working and which is 40 miles away from the homes in Bel Air. That's very important. That's a good hour's drive if you're driving during rush hour. So let's look at the actual appearances of Catherine Michelle in this case and then along the way, I'll do a little speculating. But first of all, I'm going to take this in the order that things supposedly happened in the actual timeline. So, first of all, when Don was interviewed on January 22nd by Officer Joseph O'Shea, this was after O'Shea had been put in charge of what was still a missing persons report. I've gone into this in some detail earlier. Let's look at what is said here. First of all, on this date, Don for the first time says, "Oh, I was working somewhere else on January 13th at Hunt Valley." And then O'Shea goes on to say, "Donald did not speak with Hay while he was at work. Don worked until approximately 1800 hours, that's 6 p.m. Don arrived home at 1700 hours, 7 p.m. And he was advised by his father to call the Owings Mills store. Donald called the store, and he was told that Hay Lee was missing." Now, just for context here, let me go on and also read a snippet from the trial transcript, because Don was called as a state's witness. The question, this is from Kevin Urich: "How did you come to find out that Hay Lee was missing?" Answer: "When I arrived home at 7 that afternoon from work and received a call from my lab manager asking me if I knew where she was." Now, let me first of all make a point that this phone call has been very muddled up in discussions about this case. This is not a call from the police. This is not Officer Adcock calling. He says in his reports, when he was trying to call around and contact anybody who might know where Hay was, that he tried to call Don Kleindienst and he was unsuccessful. And he kept trying to call until 1:30 a.m. the next morning. And that was when he finally got a hold of Don, and Don told him, "Well, I don't know anything about this. I haven't seen Hay since the night of the 12th. And then somebody else called during the day on the 14th and was told the same thing. So you will often hear people say, "Well, the police called and left a message for Don to call. Officer Adcock called Don's home, and Don didn't call back until 1:30 a.m. That is not true. There was no one there to take that call, or Adcock would not say, "I was unsuccessful." He would say, "I left a message," or "I talked to his dad," or "I talked to somebody." He does not say that. There was no one home. I think that's important simply because it shows that there's a level of fabrication going on here as early as January 22nd. And why does Don say this? Why does he say that his father told him to call Owings Mills? I think if you look at this logically, this is a nice way of establishing that Don was somewhere else, that he was not at the Owings Mills Mall, that he was at work somewhere else, and he wasn't home until 7. It's kind of an indirect alibi. I'm not quite sure whose idea this was. Who called from Owings Mills? Well, it has to be Catherine Michelle. Now, in the trial transcript, Don says he received a call from his lab manager, but Catherine Michelle, I think, was a general store manager. Again, not all that important, but he may be saying lab manager because he doesn't want anybody to make the connection with Catherine Michelle. Why on earth would she call Don and ask where Hay is? Well, there are several things going on here. Number one, of course, Catherine Michelle, because she lives with Anita Baird and she hears all this stuff that's going on in Anita's son's life, she knows perfectly well that Don is dating Hay. And of course, she's at the store, so she's seen all the interactions between the two of them there. So she knows perfectly well that there's a plenty going on between these two young people, her future putative stepson and this girl who was just hired the previous October. Why doesn't Catherine Michelle do what you would normally do in a situation like this and call Hayes home? I actually asked my brother-in-law, who worked for many years as a retail store manager, what he would do if someone failed to show up for his or her shift and did not call in to say what was wrong. And he said he would look at the employment records and he would call the number that was given as a contact, as a home number, and see what he could find out. But there is no record that anybody ever called the Lee household because Hay didn't show up that afternoon. I wonder if there was some kind of notation on that employment record saying, household does not speak English, something like that. And of course, as I say, Catherine Michelle knows that Don is dating Hay. I think she liked Hay. I have never heard of anybody, except for maybe Stephanie McPherson, who did not like Hay. And so she probably thought, wow, I hate to write her down as a no-show, no-call. Let me see if I can find out if maybe she's with Don somehow and they've sort of lost track of time. I think what happened is that she did indeed call Don Jr.'s home phone. Remember, nobody has cell phones. So this is the Endicott Road, the townhouse where Don Jr. and Sheila and Don III all live. I think Don III slept there, although he spent a lot of time over at his mother's house, and nobody answers. So then she thinks, well, maybe Don is over at my house. So she calls her own home. And I think she must have gotten hold of somebody, either Don or Anita Baird. Now, if she really did call at 7, by that point, I'm going to say in the timeline that I created, Don and Anita have gotten back from driving all the way to Owings Mills to pick up Don's car and driving all the way back. If you're not familiar with my timeline of the case, I would advise you to go back and listen to the relevant episode. But briefly put, if Don has driven Hay's car back to his mother's house, he has to go back and get his own car off that parking lot before the no overnight parking kicks in. All right, so she calls, she gets a hold of Don or Anita. She says, do either of you know where Hay is? She's never failed to show up for work before. And who knows what she was told? But I doubt very much that she was told the truth. I'm sure she was told something along the exact same lines that Adcock is going to be told at 1:30 the next morning. I don't know where she is. I haven't seen her since last night. So I think Catherine Michelle at this point was out of the loop. That's the only thing that explains this phone call. And I was kind of toying with the idea that maybe Catherine Michelle never knew that there was any involvement on Don's part at all, that she was simply told, Don's girlfriend has disappeared and the police are looking into it, but he doesn't know anything, so let's tell them that he was at work that day, and that'll make everything shipshape. The big spanner in the works about this idea, which I was madly in love with for about 30 seconds, is, of course, Hay's car, which, if my theory is correct, was sitting in the garage at Catherine Michelle's house. She may have come home that evening. It would be about 11, depending on when the store actually closed. If her shift went until 10, she wouldn't get home until almost 11. Since it's a single garage, they probably parked in the driveway most of the time. She may have parked in that driveway and come inside the house and never realized that there was a car and, more importantly, a body in her garage. But at some point, she's going to discover this. And I think she was probably told exactly the same story that I believe Alonzo Sellers was told by Anita Baird. My son has accidentally killed his girlfriend. His whole life is going to be ruined. We have to cover it up. Can you help? So that 7 o'clock call is the first action that we know pretty much for sure must have been from this woman, this romantic partner of Anita Baird's. Now let's move forward to February 1st, which is the only other contact that Catherine Michelle has with the police. She is called by Officer O'Shea because he's checking up on this anonymous call that has come in, probably the weekend before, as I mentioned, February 1st is a Monday, saying you ought to take a look at the boyfriend and the ex-boyfriend. That is my best guess for what that call said. We do not have a transcript. But because of what the police did on February 1st, as I've mentioned before, they check up on Adnan and they check up on Don. I think the call must have mentioned both young men. So, as I've said before, O'Shea calls the Owings Mills store and he talks to CM, which of course is Catherine Michelle, and he gets a set of times for when Don was working on January 13th. Why he didn't call the Hunt Valley store, as I mentioned before, is an open question, but because Don worded it the way he did, that he had been replacing somebody else, he had been working, taking over a shift from a friend, something to that effect, he probably thought, well, the records will be at Owings Mills. So he calls and he gets those mysteriously exact times. Don had worked from 1:02 until 6 with a 12:10 to 12:39 lunch hour, something like that. It's all to the minute. It's obviously being read off some kind of document. So that's the only time that we know of that Catherine Michelle is ever directly contacted by the police. And then, of course, we have the Deborah Renner story of almost certainly Officer O'Shea going in person to the Hunt Valley store to look at the actual physical timesheets. We don't know when Catherine Michelle found out exactly what had happened, but it almost certainly would have been clear after Hay's body was discovered. A young woman has been found hidden in the woods, strangled. And she would be sensible enough to know that you cannot strangle somebody by accident. You cannot accidentally put your hands around the neck of someone and strangle that person without meaning to do so. So I have no idea what she has been thinking since 1999. But as I have mentioned before, I found it very, very telling that she was willing to speak to Sarah Kalin, the investigator for the Undisclosed relaunch, in the episode that says specifically the title is Not Eliminated, and that phrase refers to Don Kleindienst. So she was willing to talk to Sarah Kalin, not about anything directly to do with Don. She's giving information about Robin Kelly Kleindienst's employment history. But I find the fact that she was willing to talk to Sarah Kalin at all to be very telling. And so with that, I want to move on to my wrap-up. Where could we go from here? Now, I have a chapter with that title in my book, and I'm going to rewrite that chapter quite extensively. Because in that chapter, I say, well, maybe Alonzo Sellers could come forward and make an immunity deal and testify. But of course, there would be absolutely no reason for him to do this. He has no skin in this game. so we'll leave him out. Don is not going to come forward and confess at this point. He has said, I think I've mentioned this before, I will reiterate it here. He has said, I don't expect to live past 50, and all I'm worried about is that my wife and children be provided for after I die. I will simply say he has health issues that probably, sadly, will bring about an early death. He has no motivation to come forward. And if you go back and you listen to the not eliminated episode of the Undisclosed Relaunch, you will find out that Sarah Kalin tried to talk to Don and he refused to talk to her. And Robin did talk to her briefly, but only to say, I will not be interviewed. So there is no information that's going to come from them. Bilal Ahmed and Hope Shab know nothing substantive about what actually happened, so they're non-starters. The only person in this case who does not now have a close family relationship with Don or his mother is Catherine Michelle, who knows what actually happened. And I say does not have a close family relationship simply because, as far as I've been able to determine, Michelle and Anita Baird are now divorced. That doesn't mean there is no sympathy, there are no warm feelings. I don't mean that at all. But I keep coming back to the fact that Catherine Michelle was willing to talk for the Undisclosed podcast. Maybe she will come forward. I don't see any other way for this case to be reopened. Indeed, to speak in general terms, while I believe I have built a compelling case for how this murder and its aftermath unfolded, I would be the first to admit that I have no legal evidence that could be brought to court. I think someone with law enforcement background or investigative background could possibly bring in some hard records. The one thing that could be provable is the fact that the timesheets were falsified, but that is not direct evidence of murder. So there's going to have to be a witness to come forward. And I think that that would be only right and proper. Think about what is still true in this case. The big good thing is that Adnan Syed is no longer in prison, that he's out, that he's been able to pick up at least some threads of normal life. He's gotten married. He was able to be with his father when his father died, and he has a job, and he is trying the best that he can to live the rest of his life as a productive citizen, but he still has that cloud hanging over his head. He's in no danger of going back to prison, but he is still on the books, a convicted murderer. And then, of course, the other group is the family of Haman Lee. And they, I'm sure, are tormented every day, especially Hay's brother, Young Lee, and her mother, Yoon-Hwa Kim, by the thought that Hay's killer, whom they believe Adnan to be, is walking around free. I want them to know the truth, to recognize the truth. Now, you may say, okay, I don't buy your theory. I don't buy your idea that Don Kleindienst killed Hay and that his mother and his stepmother-to-be and Alonzo Sellers, the random concrete worker, all conspired together to give him an alibi and to cover up the truth of this. And of course, that's fine. I've said all along that this is my theory. This is my conjecture. I think these ideas fit the facts as we know them. And I have refused to just say what I want to be true and not actually back it up with the specifics that we know from the witnesses, from the forensics, all that sort of thing. So if you're going to say, I think somebody else did it, that is perfectly legitimate, but you have to explain certain things. And I don't think that people understand who just want to say, oh, it was so-and-so. Well, you have to make the timeline fit and you have to make the evidence fit. I will just mention two of the major things that must be explained. Number one, you have to understand, you have to explain who could have waylaid Hay so that she never got to the Early Learning Center. That's problem number one, the waylaying, the route, and what could possibly have happened to Hay between the time that she drove out of the parking lot at Woodlawn High School and 3:15 when she was supposed to show up at Camptown Early Learning Center. You have to fit the murder into that window, the murder, or at least some kind of kidnapping, detainment, disablement, I guess would be another word you could use. And if you cannot fit your theory into that window, your theory has to fall because that's the only window we have. The forensic evidence, of course, has been gone over many times. Any theory you come up with has to explain why Hay was face down on a very smooth surface, except for her shoulders pressing against some strange little objects for 8 to 10 hours after that window. But I think one underappreciated problem, and I'm going to spend just a little bit of time on this here at the very end of episode 12, is Hay's car. I've talked about this before, but I haven't really gone into all of the details that make that car so problematic, because a car is hard to hide. So a body, sadly, can be pretty easy to hide, at least temporarily. But a car is a different matter. That car has to have been somewhere out of sight, well protected from the weather and from vandalism and theft for almost 6 weeks. And so any theory has to incorporate that idea. And if you think about some of the mysterious disappearances in famous cases of the past, where there's a woman who disappears, there's always a car left behind. So, for instance, we all know, if you're a true crime junkie, I may have mentioned this case before in these episodes. Let me refer back to it again here. Maura Murray, the case of Maura Murray, the young woman who disappeared, vanished into thin air on that snowy road in New Hampshire and has never been found. Did she go into the woods and die of hypothermia, and it's just that her remains have never been found? Did she indeed flag down a trucker, or what? But the fact of the matter is that her car was left behind. She did not vanish with her car. She went off on her own, and it's much easier to have a disappearance under those circumstances. You may be acquainted with the famous case of Agatha Christie, who had some kind of, I don't know, brainstorm or something and disappeared for days and was finally found in a hotel under the name of her husband's mistress. But her car was found. Her car was abandoned. Cars do not vanish. The only way you can really get rid of them definitively is to drive them into a lake or into the ocean or something like that. And there's that little detail from, I believe, Yasser. If Adnan ever wanted to hurt his girlfriend, he'd drive her car into a lake, which is not necessarily something he ever said. But other than that, what are you going to do with a car? So you're going to have to come up with a theory that involves that car. And so I've said Alonzo Sellers had no place to hide a car, especially if, as Bob Ruff says, he was not even living at the house he lives at now that has a nice double garage. He was living in rental housing, row houses with parking on the street. There's no way he could have hidden Hayes' car. Same goes for Bilal. Where is he going to hide his car? And of course, if there are some random guilters of Adnan who are listening to this case, well, where is Adnan supposed to have hidden that car? That's just the insoluble knot. But once you accept that there's somebody in this case who has a garage where the car could have been kept, then that problem is solved if you accept that premise. So I would challenge you, if you think I'm absolutely full of it over this whole theory, that you come up with an alternative. And with that, I'm going to bring this final episode to a close. I have been astonished at the new information, the new ideas, the new conclusions that have come to me over the course of doing this material. I hope you have found it as interesting as I have, and I will sign off for now. Thanks for listening.